Today is Tuesday, June 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. What are the societal challenges facing police reform?
There are going to be different policies that work in different contexts depending on the community and the sort of environment that a department is working in.
Plus, where do things stand 4 years after the Brexit vote?
We'll be able to respond to our economic needs in a creative and constructive way.
And the World Health Organization says a lack in leadership to fight the coronavirus is a bigger threat than the virus itself. We'll have those stories and more next. Police in Washington forcefully pushed back a group of protesters late Monday who were trying to take down a statue of former U.S. President Andrew Jackson in a park across from the White House. VOA's Jason Patinkin was there.
It's just after 8:30 p.m. outside of Lafayette Square and Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. I'm standing on the corner of Vermont and H Streets right now. There was a group of hundreds of protesters who circled around the statue of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was the 7th president of the United States and known for his extreme brutality against Native Americans. He even had the nickname Sharp Knife because of his brutality. The protesters here who support the Black Lives Matter movement wanted to pull that statue down because they said Jackson was a racist. As they surrounded that statue and threw up chains and ropes to try to pull the statue down. Police showed up. Police confronted the protesters, and violence broke out. Police used batons. They used various chemical sprays, pepper balls. They fired pepper balls at the crowd. They used pepper spray, and there ended up being dozens, if not over 100 police to push back this crowd of protesters. Eventually, the protesters fell back from the statue. I witnessed protesters being beaten with batons. Someone was arrested and was apparently hurt. It was a mixture of police and men wearing some other kind of uniform. One of those people in uniform hit me with a baton, and he would not identify which arms group or which government agency, if any, he was with. Police near him said they did not know who he was with either. It looks now like things have calmed down a bit, but protesters have set up barricades, or they had set up barricades earlier before this attempted takedown of the statue. Now the protesters are back at the barricades. It looks like they are determined to maintain their presence here outside Lafayette Square, even if they were unable to tear down the statue of the 7th president, Andrew Jackson.
That was VOA's Jason Patinkin. Lafayette Square is the same park where earlier this month, police forcefully cleared out protesters a short time before U.S. President Donald Trump walked through the area to take photos at a nearby church. In tweets on Tuesday morning, Trump said he has authorized the arrest of anyone who vandalizes or destroys any monument, statue, or other such federal property in the U.S. with up to 10 years in prison under a law to preserve veterans' memorials. The president said that the orders would take effect immediately, but may also be used retroactively for earlier acts of destruction or vandalism. Demonstrators have damaged or toppled several Confederate monuments across the country that honor those who lost America's Civil War in the 19th century. VOA's Mariama Diallo explains why.
At this demonstration in Richmond, Virginia, protesters demanded that certain monuments be taken down. Monuments that pay tribute to men who backed the American Confederacy and the protection of slavery.
The fact that it's been over almost 200 years since the end of slavery, and we're still dealing with racism, we're still dealing with police brutality, we're still dealing with unequal treatment, and these Confederate monuments are symbols to the past, and it's symbols to a made-up past because, you know, the monuments are basically the physical representation of the myth of the Old South.
Between 1880 and 1890 is when many Confederate monuments began to be erected in the U.S. South, says Professor Sarah Beetham.
Almost every southern county has a Confederate monument on the courthouse lawn. When you think about the history of lynching, that's the place where often a victim is kidnapped from, or where a sham trial takes place before a terrible event occurs to that person. And so these monuments become really indelibly linked with that. And it's really hard not to see them as anything other than these really state-sponsored signs of white supremacy.
In Washington, D.C., cheering demonstrators jumped up and down as some of them used group force to topple this 3.5-meter statue of Confederate General Albert Pike as local police stood nearby. On Sunday in Raleigh, North Carolina, people cheered as authorities finished the job started by protesters Friday and removed a Confederate statue from its pedestal. In Decatur, Georgia, activists celebrated as the stone obelisk they say is a nod to white supremacy was ordered removed by a judge.
It's a people's victory. All of our young people from Decatur High School, they made this happen. All of these organizers, everybody came together.
At a rally in Oklahoma over the weekend, U.S. President Donald Trump spoke about activists who had pulled down statues of Confederate soldiers and defaced monuments.
The unhinged left-wing mob is trying to vandalize our history, desecrate our monuments, our beautiful monuments.
Last Thursday, Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri blocked the Senate from passing a bill proposed by Senate Democrats Cory Booker and Charles Schumer to remove Confederate statues from the U.S. Capitol.
The continued presence of these statues in the halls is an affront to African Americans and the ideals of our nation.
But Blunt objected, noting that Congress had an agreement with states and that he wanted time to consider giving the issue a hearing in the Rules Committee, which he chairs.
I think that today's action would violate our agreements with the states.
About a dozen figures in the U.S. Capitol's National Statuary Hall collection honor men who gave their allegiance to the Confederate States of America during the American Civil War in the 1860s. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
The protests against systemic racism were sparked by the May 25th death of George Floyd while in police custody. In addition to calls to address hundreds of years of inequality, there's been a growing effort to enact meaningful and long-lasting police reform. Emily Owens is a professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the University of California, Irvine. She told me via Skype, that's no easy task.
I can think of three specific ones, and I think there's been a varying amount of progress made along each of these dimensions. So the first is that police officers have a huge amount of discretion when it comes to what they do when they're on the job. And this is part because, until very recently, I would say over the last 15, 20 years, even departments themselves didn't have a lot of information about what officers were doing once they, finished their roll call meeting and went out into the field. What's changed is the rise of things like cameras, either in the dash of a police car or, increasingly on, an officer themselves that's actually providing a record of how officers are interacting with citizens. If you don't know what your employees are
right,
doing.
Right, yeah. If you don't know what the problems are, you can't go around and try to fix them. And I can see how that is a huge, huge issue. So what makes it so difficult, aside from not having the background information of what the police officers are doing, to actually get meaningful reform and meaningful changes in police behavior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so that leads to the second point, right, which is that in terms of understanding what types of policies are going to impact police behavior, even as basic as what types of training that an officer receives either in the academy or, on sort of a regular basis, there has been a surprisingly small amount of evidence on what types of training programs, for example, actually impact officer behavior in the field. And so, when you mentioned consent decrees, which are something certainly, in the Obama administration, the federal government was doing a lot to try to constrain or correct officer behavior when they thought individual police departments were engaged in a pattern and practice of violating civil rights. The impact of consent decrees or some of the training programs that consent decrees will, require agencies to put in place, haven't really been evaluated in the sense that we've, gone to one agency and instituted these changes and then compared what officers are doing or outcomes for that agency to another similar department.
So what was the third thing that you were mentioning?
The third point is that there is still a huge gap. It's related to the first two. You know, there's a big gap between what a policy is and what officers are doing in the field. Just in terms of the implement, what Cynthia Lum, a colleague of mine at George Mason, just did a very sort of large study where she went to a handful of large police agencies that had implemented proactive policing policies. And she sort of figured out exactly what the policies are. And then she and her research team, you know, went on ride-alongs with police officers and sort of conducted systematic observations. And she documented a huge gap between what the policy was and what the officers were actually doing on the ground. And this is related to the discretion that police officers have.
So this brings, you know, of course, to the question that so many people around the world have. How do you bring about reform if we don't know what's worked what's worked in the past and how to get there?
Yeah, it's a very interesting time. Something that is true is that there are 18,000 local agencies that provide law enforcement in the United States. There are going to be different policies that work in different contexts depending on the community and the sort of environment that a department is working in. I don't think that any one response should be off the table, sort of dismissed offhand.
Emily Owens is a professor at UC Irvine and teaches in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society. U.S. President Donald Trump is curbing immigration visas for many categories of foreign workers for the rest of the year, saying it was because of the economic damage done by the coronavirus pandemic, including the job losses of American workers. AP correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
Saying the move will free up jobs for Americans in an economy hard hit by the coronavirus, the Trump administration has announced a ban on green cards issued outside the United States will continue until the end of the year. President Donald Trump had imposed a 60-day ban on green cards issued abroad in April. The ban was set to expire Monday. The ban now applies to H-1B visas, H-2B visas, J-1 visas, and L-1 visas. There will be exceptions for food processing workers and healthcare workers helping fight COVID-19. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A poll conducted last month by the Washington Post and the University of Maryland found that 65% of Americans support halting most immigration visas during the coronavirus pandemic. The poll found Republicans widely support such measures, while Democrats were split. Today, President Trump heads to the southwestern state of Arizona to view part of the border wall that was a key component of his 2016 election campaign, and to meet with supporters. Coming up later in today's program,
there are no particular restrictions on the judges to be designated by the chief executive onto the future sort of group to adjudicate these national security cases.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study published in the journal Science suggests that South American monkeys are descendants of ancient primates from Africa. The study authors, led by Eric Seifert of the University of Southern California, analyzed four fossilized monkey teeth that were discovered deep in the Peruvian Amazon about 5 years ago. From their research, the authors proposed that some 34 million years ago, these prehistoric primates made their way across the Atlantic Ocean from Africa aboard rafts of vegetation that were severed from coastlines, perhaps in the midst of a storm. The researchers say the fossilized monkey teeth came from a recently found species they call Ucayali lepithecus perdita. They propose that this ancient monkey species may have been very small and similar in size to today's marmoset. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Top U.S. public health officials are set to go before a congressional panel Tuesday as parts of the country grapple with a surge in new confirmed coronavirus cases and hospitalizations, mainly in the southern and western states. Britain announced that it will also be relaxing pandemic restrictions on July 4th, In addition to businesses like neighborhood pubs being allowed to reopen, physical distancing requirements will be reduced to 1 meter. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has more on this global pandemic as the total number of COVID-19 cases surpasses 9.1 million.
The number of global coronavirus cases continues to surge in many countries that have been lifting lockdowns, even as new infections stabilize or drop in parts of Western Europe. India has been recording about 15,000 new infections each day, with some states there considering fresh lockdowns measured to try to halt the spread. The government earlier lifted a nationwide lockdown in a bid to restart the ailing economy, which has shed millions of jobs, while hospitals in Pakistan have been turning away patients. The economy there may be teetering, but the government remains determined to reopen the country. And new cases are also rising steeply in Mexico, Colombia and Indonesia. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The head of the World Health Organization said on Monday that a lack of global leadership to fight the virus is a bigger threat than the virus itself.
The world is in desperate need of national unity and global solidarity. The politicization of the pandemic has exacerbated it. Ultimately, the pandemic has shown that we are humanity, one humanity. And none of us are safe until all of us are safe.
Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus also said all countries must make universal health care a priority, warning the world had learned the hard way that strong health care systems were the foundation of global health security and of social and economic development.
The consequences of these disruptions will be felt for many years to come. The world is learning the hard way that health is not a luxury item. It's the cornerstone of security, stability, and prosperity.
The WHO has warned that the pandemic is accelerating. We have additional information on the pandemic at our website, that address, voanews.com. Malawians are choosing the country's president Tuesday in a do-over election, a year after President Peter Mutharika's re-election was annulled over vote rigging. Some voters were lining up before dawn to cast their ballots in the much-anticipated election. The fresh polls come after the country's constitutional court in February annulled the May 2019 elections over massive irregularities, a decision that the Supreme Court of Appeal upheld in May. Chinese and Indian military commanders have agreed to disengage their forces in a disputed area of the Himalayas following a clash that left at least 20 soldiers dead. Both countries say the commanders reached an agreement on Monday in their first meeting since the June 15th confrontation. A Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson says the two sides agreed to take appropriate measures to cool down the situation. He also denied apparent speculation by the Indian government that 40 Chinese troops had died in the clash. France's counterterrorism prosecutors have made a formal request for 9 suspects to face trial in connection with the 2016 Bastille Day truck attack in Nice that left 86 people dead. The Paris prosecutor's office did not disclose the identity of the suspects. 4 of the suspects have been charged with terrorist conspiracy for alleged links to the attacker who plowed a 19-ton truck down Nice's Promenade des Anglais into a crowd assembled for the July 14 fireworks display. 5 other suspects have been charged with other criminal charges, including for allegedly providing arms for the assault. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam said on Tuesday that she will not handpick judges to preside over cases brought under the city's new security law, an apparent attempt to mitigate concerns about the controversial legislation.
There are no particular restrictions on the judges to be designated by the chief executive onto the future sort of group to adjudicate these national security cases. Hong Kong is very blessed with a large number of very distinguished foreign judges sitting on the Court of Final Appeal. We now have 15 coming from UK, Canada, and Australia.
Lam said that she would appoint a panel of judges for all courts based on recommendations from a judicial body. The full details of the legislation have not been made public, and Lam acknowledged she also is yet to view the entire document. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said a deal to finalize Britain's departure from the European Union could be sealed in July with a bit of oomph. But EU officials say they see no way through the Brexit deadlock. On the fourth anniversary of Britain's historic vote, Reuters' Megan Revelle explains where things stand.
Let June the 23rd go down in our history as our Independence Day!
It's been 4 years since Britain voted to leave the EU. At the time, Boris Johnson stressed there was no rush.
There is now no need for haste.
But now, as Britain's Prime Minister, he's under a time crunch.
The faster we can do this, the better. I mean, put a tiger in the tank.
Britain officially left the bloc in January. But talks on a trade agreement, remember one of the biggest issues of the Brexit debate, have made little progress. Johnson wants a loose trade deal, but the bloc is seeking much closer ties. For the EU's chief executive, Ursula von der Leyen, there will be no deal without three things.
Without fisheries, without a level playing field, or without strong governance mechanisms.
Let's take a closer look at those areas. When it comes to fishing, Britain wants to be able to keep selling British seafood to the 450 million people in the EU.
We've got to get a great deal for our fish. We're taking back control of our fish.
But EU fishermen want access to British waters. This trade-off between access to the EU market and British waters is at the heart of the dispute. When it comes to competition, Britain will no longer be bound by costly EU standards, such as on labour and environmental rules. EU officials believe this will give British companies an unfair advantage and say similar standards must be upheld if Britain wants that easy access to their market. Finally, there's governance and the need to create a way of settling future disputes. The EU can only accept its own top court, the Court of Justice of the European Union. But that's a red line for Johnson.
We can't have a system whereby we continue to have to obey EU law even when we're out of the EU.
So is all of this insurmountable, or are we facing a hard Brexit? Both sides have adopted a more conciliatory tone of late, agreeing for the greater need for creativity.
We will be able to respond to our economic needs in a creative and constructive way.
And we're ready to be creative, to find common ground where there even seems to be none.
Johnson and EU leaders say a deal is possible, but time is running out.
That we are now halfway through these negotiations with 5 months left to go. But we're definitely not halfway through the work to reach an agreement.
September has been referred to as the hot phase, with October being the more informal deadline for a deal. That would give just enough time for it to be ratified before the cliff edge at the end of the year. There were multiple extensions on the transition deal, but Johnson has said December 31st is a hard deadline.
But what we need now is to see a bit of oomph in the negotiation.
Megan Revelle reports for Reuters News. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, on Tuesday called for an immediate ceasefire in Libya, adding that Turkey and Egypt agreed with Moscow's approach to settle the conflict. The comments come after President Emmanuel Macron said on Monday that France will not tolerate Turkey's military intervention in Libya's civil war. He accused Ankara of playing a dangerous game. Turkey has intervened decisively in recent weeks, providing air support, weapons, and allied fighters from Syria to help the government based in Tripoli repel a year-long assault by Eastern military leader Khalifa Haftar. Turkey's help appears to have secured Libya's capital and the west of the country for the Tripoli government against Haftar's Libyan National Army, which is backed by the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, and Russia. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.